story of Terry Schindler Schiavo is an important one, and it raises a bigger question. It raises a question that must be answered. That question being, there's no specific will that she has put down to say what she wanted. Her husband says she wants to die. He wants to basically perform euthanasia. There are people who do have a will. They can speak. They're not Terry Schindler Schiavo. They're not incapacitated. And they say, I want to die. There are also those who want to have someone else help them die. We're going to be talking about assisted suicide and euthanasia during this hour of Issues, Etc. with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, a regular guest here on the program. Feel free to join us at 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, as we talk with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery during this hour in our ongoing series on Christianity and civil law. Today, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and suicide. We'll start out talking about suicide in the law. Why has it been considered a crime to kill yourself? After all, you're only hurting yourself. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks very much. You never just hurt yourself. As the Christian poet and preacher John Donne remarked, you ask for whom the bell tolls when a bell indicates the death of someone. It tolls for thee. That is to say, as Hemingway used the title, For Whom the Bell Tolls, there is no isolation in human life. Every life is interlocked with other people. So a suicide never just influences the individual whose life is lost. That's one point. Sir William Blackstone, who did the first textbook of the English common law in the 18th century, same time as Dr. Johnson, he said that, and I'm quoting him directly, "The law of England wisely and religiously considers that no man hath a power to destroy life, but by commission from God, the author of it. The suicide is guilty of a double offense, one spiritual in evading the prerogative of the Almighty and rushing into his immediate presence uncalled for. The other temporal, against the king, who hath an interest in the preservation of his subjects." In other words, a person who commits suicide, of course, diminishes the body politic, and therefore this is an offense against the people who are still alive, because that individual is no longer there doing whatever he can or she can in that context. But the most important thing is that God has given life, and we don't have any business taking it into our own hands and eliminating it, unless Holy Scripture gives us that specific justification in a certain situation. And certainly, Scripture does not justify suicide or assisting suicide.
Now, the ethos of the law today seems to be running completely against that, at least here in the United States, Dr. Montgomery, in that along with the right to, say, terminate a pregnancy, have an abortion, comes along in the same kind of logical path. If it's my body and I have a right to do with it as I choose, the right to take my own life in whatever fashion and at whatever time for whatever cause I see fit. I would think if there's a right to do it, it's got to be absolute.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that the modern law doesn't go along with Blackstone. For one thing, suicide has been decriminalized, and I suppose there may be some practical point to this. If a person successfully kills himself, then there's not very much you can do about it, right? But the law certainly should not allow people to assist others to commit suicide. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And yet the law does in many contexts. Fortunately, not in the United States yet. There was a case that came before the state of Washington and then went to the Ninth Circuit Federal Court. This is known as the Compassion in Dying versus the State of Washington case. And it's very interesting. Those who argued for the right to assist someone to terminate his life used exactly the reasoning in the famous or infamous abortion decision Roe versus Wade, the argument being that a person has an absolute right over his own life. Fortunately, that case was not allowed to come before the Supreme Court, and therefore the negative judgment in the case holds. So in Washington, you cannot commit suicide. You cannot assist someone in committing suicide. I understand that there has been some recent activity legally in the state of Oregon to allow this. There's no question but what there is pressure in all states and Western countries to increase the possibilities to help others terminate their life. And this is directly against Scripture. It's directly against the historic common law.
Give us a brief history, if you would, talking about suicide simply first, and then we'll go on to talk about a physician-assisted suicide and the others. Give us a brief history of suicide in the law and how we've got to the point where, as you mentioned, suicide has been largely decriminalized.
Well, as we've said, in the case of Blackstone and the other classic authorities of the English common law, and this and these influenced the American common law until very recently, suicide and assisted suicide were regarded as an affront to the state and an affront to God, and therefore these were criminalized. The modern secular views on this subject derive entirely from non-Christian sources, particularly sources that surfaced during the 18th century Enlightenment. For example, you have authorities such as Hume, David Hume, who argued against miracles, and Voltaire, who was a major secular figure of the Enlightenment, arguing that there's no reason at all to consider suicide a bad thing. In fact, it ought to be regarded as something positive, for goodness sake. One example of this, Montesquieu, in his essay on suicide in 1783, concluded that, quote, "the life of a man is of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster," unquote, which showed that, by the way, that he wasn't as French as he's normally regarded, because any Frenchman has a much higher view of the oyster in connection with cuisine. This is the kind of viewpoint that directly contradicts Jesus, who says that you are of more value than many sparrows. Jesus didn't mention oysters, but I would imagine that if we are of more value than sparrows, we're certainly of more value than oysters.
In reading your chapter on suicide and assisted suicide, I was interested to discover that there was a time when suicide actually had penalties attached to it. I mean, you can hardly punish the person himself after they have committed suicide successfully. What kind of penalties were attached to suicide?
Well, the most common one was the forfeiture of the possessions of the person who committed suicide to the king or to the state. And, of course, that was a great deterrent to committing suicide, because that meant that your family would not receive your possessions. In some instances, there were symbolic penalties, such as being buried at a crossroads with a clear indication as to what you had done. This was taken very seriously. But, you know, that's the difference between a Christian culture in which the human being is regarded as of infinite importance according to God's revelation in Scripture, and a modern civilization in which there is no absolute authority at all, and therefore, you do whatever you want personally. This is the choice approach, the pro-choice approach, that I have a right to do anything whatsoever I want to do with my own body, which, of course, is a lot of nonsense anyway. I mean, as someone has said, your rights end where my nose begins. I mean, we don't have an absolute right to do any damn fool thing we want to. The fact of the matter is that our actions have an impact on other people, and therefore there is always a limitation in the law on this, and there ought to be the kind of limitations that Holy Scripture sets forth.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about suicide, assisted suicide, and euthanasia in the law. As part six of our eight-part series on Christianity and civil law, Dr. Montgomery is a regular guest, professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Christ, Our Advocate, which forms the basis for this ongoing series with Dr. Montgomery. Now, you can find out more about the book, Christ, Our Advocate, on the web at CILTPP.com. That's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, CILTPP.com. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Something you just said there, Dr. Montgomery, makes me wonder if the principle, the foolish principle that I have a right to do anything I want to with my own body, were consistently held, what effect would it have on the other civil and criminal laws in general, not just pertaining to whether one takes one's own life or just takes someone else's life? What effect would it have on law in general?
Well, here's an analogy. It's argued that because of an alleged right to silence and a right to privacy in the Constitution, a woman has a right to an abortion during the first 3 months of pregnancy and perhaps beyond that. This has been argued by the Supreme Court of the United States in Roe versus Wade. All right. Now, if the woman's right to do anything she wants with her own body allows her to kill an unborn infant during the first trimester of pregnancy in order to avoid anyone knowing about the fact that she's pregnant, to protect her right to privacy, for example, then if we take this kind of an approach that she can do anything she wants with her own body, what about my standard illustration of the obnoxious encyclopedia salesman? He throws literature into my bedroom late at night. He tosses sample volumes of the encyclopedia into my study when I'm working on important projects. And I am sick and tired of this. He has definitely violated my right to privacy. Fine. In that case, since I can do anything I want to protect myself, then why can't I simply shoot him? But that obviously would be regarded as an excessive use of my right to do what I want with my own body and with my own right to privacy. And under those circumstances, clearly any such right has limits. And the question is, what should the limits be? Well, Holy Scripture says that a human life is so important that you are not to take it into your own hands, unless there is specific justification for this. In the case of defending yourself against a maniac or defending your country in time of war, that sort of thing. So those exceptions do not apply in this situation, and the fact of the matter is that a pregnant woman does not biblically have the right to get rid of the unborn child in order to protect her right to privacy. And she does not have an absolute right over her own body. Her own body, in this case, happens to be carrying another human being. And she cannot, must not, ethically destroy that human being in order to protect her own rights, whatever they happen to be.
Is it true, Dr. Montgomery, with regard to suicide, that it was considered legally the equivalent of murder in the past?
Oh, yes, very definitely, because it was murder committed upon yourself. It was a voluntary, premeditated act that got rid of a human life, and that's exactly what murder is.
What about assisted suicide? That sounds like a very contemporary subject. Has it been addressed in the history of jurisprudence when someone assists in a suicide?
Yes, and such a person has been regarded as criminally liable because they have done this. They have assisted, just as if you happen to drive the car in a bank robbery, you are going to be criminally liable for your involvement in that crime. So, there's no question about the fact that assisted suicide has been regarded that way. The problem today is that because of political correctness and the like, many people are arguing that if a person is in great pain and their life is inevitably going to end anyway, that it would be perfectly all right to help them along and terminate their life earlier. In England, just in the last month, there is in France, just in the last month, there has been a law that will certainly be passed by the French Parliament, by the equivalent of the Congress in the United States, which will, on a very limited level, allow doctors to withdraw food, nutriment, and necessary life-giving medicines to people in that condition. It does not allow them, as in the Netherlands, actually to inject the patient with something that will kill it. So it's not what is known as active euthanasia, but it will be possible in France legally for passive euthanasia to take place probably by the end of this year.
So when we talk about euthanasia, that would be the broader category into which we might put assisted suicide or even suicide itself, if we're talking about the context of, you know, the conversation about that we have about euthanasia nowadays.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Assisted suicide would fall directly into the euthanasia category.
I started out the hour by talking about briefly about the case of Terry Schindler Schiavo here in the States. She's in Florida, mentally and physically incapacitated. The debate is whether or not she's in a persistent vegetative state. That interesting little medical category. Her case is being heard again by a law that is keeping her alive is being heard for its constitutionality by the Florida Supreme Court. Now, the argument here is not that she should be allowed to kill herself, because her will in this matter is really unknown, but her husband, who is also sadly her caretaker, says, well, I think I know what she would have wanted, and I want to withdraw the food and the nutrients and allow her to be starved and dehydrated to death, because that's what she would have wanted. He says that wouldn't be murder. That would be giving her what she wants. How do you respond to that?
Well, if she did not expressly state that that's what she wanted done, then it would be highly dangerous for the courts to take the husband's statement to this effect. I mean, my goodness, in the Netherlands, for example, there have been egregious examples of the misuse of this sort of thing, where relatives have claimed that someone in a vegetative state really wants to die, and what they've wanted is to get them out of the picture so that their estate will be will pass to the relatives, this sort of thing. I mean, this is terribly dangerous, where a person's life is concerned. If they themselves have not stated what they want to have done, then one certainly shouldn't rely upon a relative. And it seems to me that it's also very dangerous to rely upon a hospital committee or whatever. The problem here is a practical one. If there are limited medical resources available, and someone is being kept alive at tremendous expense, where the equipment could be used for other people, maybe in a more effective way, to keep other people alive who might have some chance of recovery, you might be able to argue on a lesser of two evils principle that it would be better to have the equipment used for the second group, let's say, than for the first. But obviously a far better solution to this is to put more money into medical equipment so you don't have to take the equipment off of someone who might possibly recover later. There have been lots of instances where people have apparently been in a vegetative state forever, and all at once they've woken up, for goodness sake. I mean, medicine is anything but an exact science. Really. This is why when you go to the doctor and you have a problem, he says, go home, take two aspirin, and call me next week. The reason he says this is that he hasn't got the faintest idea what's the matter with you, and he hopes something really serious will develop that he can actually treat. Okay? So the fact is that the medical activity is a fairly primitive science. It is not an exact science. And under these conditions, it would be better, for goodness sake, not to pull the plug on somebody, because who knows? They may very well recover.
Okay, so here's an argument that I think probably has some currency among those who are advocates of assisted suicide and euthanasia. They will make kind of the burden argument, Dr. Montgomery. If I'm not a burden to my immediate family by my infirm state, perhaps I'm a burden on society. And arguing against the whole Blackstone opinion that you talked about earlier, maybe I'm actually doing the king a favor by taking myself out of the picture, because he won't have to waste any of his expenses on me. I'm not contributing to society. And so I would like to voluntarily, of my own free will, either commit suicide or have someone help me do it.
Yeah, the problem with that argument is that we have a very limited perspective on our own importance. People really do not know the impact that they have on other people's lives. If the good Lord would like to have us out of the picture, the good Lord is entirely capable of doing this. For the individual to think that he or she can analyze his or her position in the universe successfully is a piece of arrogance. There's no question about that. We just don't know how our lives fit into the total picture. There are these wonderful factual incidents of terminally ill people who have had an incredible impact on those around them. I was an assistant pastor at one time in Virginia, and my senior pastor became terminally ill and was in the hospital for about 6 months. Now, there was no question but what he was going to die, and theoretically, you know, they could have gotten rid of him, I suppose, immediately. But during those 6 months, his witness and his impact on the medical people who assisted him, the nurses, the doctors, the orderlies, and all that, was absolutely incredible. It was tremendously positive. He may have done more in those 6 months than he had done in years of ordinary preaching. I mean, we just don't know how our lives impact. And there's the other side of this coin too. Lord Hailsham of St. Marylebone, who was Lord Chancellor in England twice, a historical event, I knew him, and he, in his first autobiography, he said, my brother committed suicide. He said, if my brother had had any conception of the impact that would have on everybody who knew him for the rest of their lives, he never would have done this in the world.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We'll take your phone calls after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I guess you've probably seen the healing services on television, but do these faith healers have a biblical understanding of faith and healing? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is titled Order Restored, A Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Order Restored costs $20.99, plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Order Restored on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. How important are faith, attitude, and community in healing and wellness? Find out with Order Restored, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. 1-800-325-3040. Or look it up on issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The SAT scores are in for college-bound seniors and overall nationwide. The results are flat. The numbers represent an important benchmark for students as well as for the education system as a whole. Stuart Shepherd reports.
Big Hollywood smile looking right here. All right, good.
It's senior picture day, and the smiles are as bright as the flash. Just as the camera captures a moment in these students' lives, so does the SAT.
I liked the verbal part. I didn't like the math part.
The SATs were pretty easy, really.
High school seniors Andy Holstein and Sarah Gotch see the SAT as an important gateway to their futures.
That's kind of necessary, is to have a good SAT score.
It's important to me because I'd like to be able to get into a good school and maybe be able to get some scholarships and stuff.
Nationally on the SAT, verbal scores rose 1 point, while math scores were down 1. Overall scores have been generally rising for the past 10 years.
It's certainly good that the scores went up 1 point, but I don't think that's yet cause for celebration.
Kathleen Porter-McGee with the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation says future increases will require raising standards across the board.
Students will rise to the level of expectation, and I think that if we raise standards in elementary school classrooms, middle school, and high school, we'll see increases across the board in test scores, in student achievements, and in the overall quality of education.
Education experts say parents concerned about their child's scores should begin by being actively involved in their child's education from day one, always making sure the type of schooling fits the individual. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
A new SAT will be unveiled in March. That test will include a student-written essay, higher-level math, and more reading passages. On the current test, average math scores are up 14 points compared to 10 years ago, which is driving the overall improvement in test scores nationwide. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. Have you ever wondered how biblical illiteracy affects the church, our families, our culture? Join us next time as Tim Hetzner of Lutheran Church Charities and I talk about biblical illiteracy, the problem and the solution.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
The book is titled Order Restored, A Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing, and it's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. The cost is $20.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Do modern-day faith healers have a biblical understanding of faith and healing? Find out with Order Restored. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section.
Folks, we're ready to respond to your email and your phone calls on suicide and assisted suicide. Our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. That comes to us right here in the studio. issuesetc@kfuo.org. And our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He also serves as Distinguished Professor of Apologetics in the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he's authored and edited more than 50 books, including Christ Our Advocate. Lisa writes this from Houston, Texas. Dr. Montgomery, two questions. We'll take them one at a time. When I hear people espouse the quote-unquote right to die, I think they very often mean it's better to be dead than disabled. If they know who they are talking to, and I think that Lisa is disabled, Dr. Montgomery, they sometimes follow up with a, you, of course, are the exception. Your response?
I don't understand. Who's the exception?
Well, Lisa
herself?
Well, yes, when Lisa is disabled and people espouse a right to die, they find out she's disabled, then they quickly follow up with the disclaimer, you, of course, are the exception.
Ah, well, the question would be why she would be an exception. I mean, if being disabled is somehow less valuable than being alive at all, then it would cover her as well. And I suppose that if they suddenly realize the problem, they have admitted to themselves that this is a very, very poor principle. Lisa's very existence is a clear indication that being disabled is not the worst thing that can happen. I mean, you know, in many respects, every one of us is disabled, right? I mean, when I was at university, I took a course in logic, right? And I did extremely well. I got a 98 in this thing. And then I got puffed up, and so I signed up for a course in advanced symbolic logic. And I got into this thing, and within the first 2 or 3 weeks, I realized that this was absolutely beyond my capacity. It was beyond my capacity. If I stayed in this thing, I would fail it. And so I dropped it, thank heaven, and it didn't influence my average. I mean, in that respect, in handling that kind of material, I was disabled. Everybody has limitations, for goodness sake. And limitations don't remove from your humanity. They are simply part of a fallen world. And what one needs to do is to see why one's abilities are channeled in other areas, and what one can do to serve God to the maximum with the capacities that one has.
Lisa also asked for your reaction to this. She says, I watched one discussion on the internet where they really were discussing the obligation to die, not just the right, but the obligation to die if you are a drain on society's resources. Respond to this, Dr. Montgomery.
Well, we're all a drain on society's resources, aren't we? I mean, after all, we benefit from all sorts of public utilities and the like. And so if that argument were valid, I suppose that if 75% of the populace immediately committed suicide, it would cut down immensely on the public pressure, taxation pressure, and all the rest of it. I mean, that would be absolutely wonderful, wouldn't it? I mean, of all the nonsense, I mean, what sort of imbecile would argue that way? I mean, obviously, every human being both contributes to society and receives societal benefits. So the idea that that you can analyze yourself exactly what your value to society is and then decide whether or not you should snuff yourself is a lot of nonsense. There's no way in the world you can analyze this. As we said in the first part of the program, the impact that one life has on other lives is something that no one can calculate. I mean, only in eternity, when we can see the effect of our life on all of the people we've had contact with through our earthly existence, will we have any idea as to the significance of what we've done. This is why the way to handle this thing is, first of all, to recognize that you are a sinner, you can't save yourself, and you certainly can't analyze your position in society and in eternity. And you go to the cross, you get on your knees, you accept what Christ has done for you, and then you're transformed by Him, and your perspective on these matters becomes the perspective that He has given in Holy Scripture. That's the way to live the kind of life that will mean something, for goodness sake. But to sit around as a stupid secularist and try to analyze your value in society, you know, is a perfect waste of time. You know, you might as well be working on the flat earth theory for all the good it does anybody.
1-800-730-2727. That's our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Taking your email and your calls for Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on suicide, assisted suicide, and euthanasia. Our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. You also write, Dr. Montgomery, that this whole right to die movement really is a playground for the situation ethicist. Example, of course, your old nemesis, Joseph Fletcher. Why so?
Well, because the people who argue for suicide and assisted suicide are not functioning from any kind of absolute ethic at all. If they had an absolute ethic, it would have to come from Scripture, and Scripture is against that sort of thing. So what they do is to use the situationist approach, which is, determine what the current situation is, and then ethical principles will bubble up from that context. And this is nonsense. It really is. I mean, when you're in an ethical mess of one sort or another, the principles are not going to appear as if by magic. I mean, this is little more than a sort of primitive magic in which you assume that answers are going to arise from the situation in which you find yourself. If you don't have solid principles to bring to these situations, then you're going to be, what, up the ethical creek without a paddle.
And it seems as though the situation ethicist in this case wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wants to be able to maintain, for his own personal safety, he wants to keep someone else from walking around saying, look, you, Dr. Fletcher, are a drain on society's resources, and so I deem you too much of an expense. Here, karate chop, you're dead. So he wants to maintain his own personal safety, but he also wants to be able to say, if the situation is different and I'm laying in a bed, then I don't necessarily deserve protections.
Well, I think that's right. It's very interesting that the relativist, the situation ethicist who's a relativist and has no absolute principles, nevertheless always seems to think that his own position and the advice that he's offering to everyone else in some sense turn out to be absolute. These one must not question or argue with, which is rather amusing. I mean, it's an illustration of the fact, you know, that you've got to start any discussion from some sort of absolute. And if you think you don't have any, and you start making declarations, then that's an indication that you think at least those declarations have that kind of absolute value. It's most interesting. This goes along with Tillich's notion that there are really no atheists. Everybody has a god of some sort. For many people, sad to say, that god is themselves and their own value system and what they consider to be important. And the real problem then is not atheism. The real problem is the false gods that people are worshiping instead of going to the God who is real and who died for them in Jesus Christ.
Let's deal with, you have a list of three objections. We've dealt with one of them rather at length, but I want to deal with all three of them again here as our time winds down in our conversation, Dr. Montgomery. Objections that people who would be in favor of suicide-assisted suicide euthanasia put forward, and I'd like you to respond to them. The first one is that suicide and assisted suicide should be a matter of private morality on which the state should not offer any legislation.
Yes, the fallacy of this, of course, is that our lives have public value, and therefore it's essential that there be some kind of legal and political standards for all of this. I mean, for example, suppose I were to say, well, I'm an Aztec, and what I really enjoy doing is engaging in human sacrifice, and therefore my next-door neighbor would be an ideal example of this. And after all, this is a matter of religious freedom, and so I ought not to have any public interference in what I want to do. Well, I mean, we'd obviously see that is not correct. Okay, fine. If that isn't correct, then it's also not allowable for example, Jehovah's Witnesses to refuse blood transfusion to their minor children. It's also not going to be possible for Christian Scientists to use their crackpot practitioners instead of qualified medical personnel. Of course, the state has got to enter into these things and deal with the whole business from the standpoint of the public and societal necessity.
We're basing this series on Christianity and Civil Law on a book that Dr. John Warwick Montgomery has written called Christ Our Advocate. It's among his many books that he has authored and edited. You can purchase this book by calling 780-461-3076. 780-461-3076. That is the number for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. Or you can find out more on the web by going to their website, CILTPP.com. CILTPP.com. It's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. The book you want to ask about is called Christ, Our Advocate, by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery, again, is suicide or assisted suicide an act harmless to others? Is it, in effect, harming only oneself?
It certainly isn't, and it's unfortunate that in the legal area, in the ethical area, it's been written about as a victimless crime, if it's a crime at all. This is certainly not the case. Glanville Williams in England, a very, very prominent philosopher of law, considered suicide as a practice freely consented to that does not harm others, unquote. I mean, this is just nonsense. Have none of these people read John Donne? You ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. We are all interlocked in society, and there is no life that has no impact on others. And that means that we ought to follow God's standards of what should be done with individual human life and not take this on ourselves as if we could make those decisions cosmically.
The other objection that is raised has to do with really, it's put in modern terms today as you have no right to legislate your morality. But it's if there are Christian objections to suicide or assisted suicide, that's fine and good, but you have no right to impose those views in a pluralistic society. Your response to that advocacy for assisted suicide?
Well, if we have a modern democratic society, then of course Christians have every right to persuade others of the importance of human life, and if it's a democracy, then we all have a right to vote on this. And if we are able to obtain a majority against the kind of assisted suicide and euthanasia that we've been talking about in this program, that's just fine. I don't see how the unbeliever can object to this. If it's a democratic society, you've got a right to try to create the right sort of society by democratic means. Now, of course, this doesn't justify Christians massing together and trying to force peculiar religious views of their own on a pluralistic society. For example, it would certainly not justify Christians of the Reconstructionist viewpoint establishing Sunday legislation that would prevent people who are not Christian from going to stores on Sunday or whatever. But we're talking here about something that is much more fundamental than that. We're talking about the value of human life, and where human life is concerned, obviously, if a person's dead, none of the other rights exist any longer for him, so that Christians certainly have every reason, every solid reason to amass support for the support of human life across the board. And if non-Christians don't like that, well, it's just tough for them. Actually, we're helping them. The life that we save might be their own where it comes to suicide, euthanasia, abortion, or the rest of it.
I think about the words of that philosophical foundation for the American state, the Declaration of Independence, where the inalienable rights, the list is headed up by the right to life, and as you've just pointed out, that really is the right without which you have no other rights. Would you go so far as to say the suicide, however it is accomplished, is also violating that principle? He is in taking away his own life, he is without authorization depriving himself of every right that devolves to human beings.
Oh, sure. No question about that. An inalienable right is a right which not only somebody else must not take away from you, but which you have no business taking away from yourself. That's exactly the idea of an inalienable right. And without an absolute justification of such a right, you just don't have such a thing. I mean, the writers of the Declaration of Independence were essentially deists and not practicing Christians themselves, but they picked up this notion of inalienable rights from the Christian tradition. because it's only from a clear revelation from God that we can establish such a right. You don't get absolutes from anything but an absolute source. And if God has established the right to life, then no human being can take it away. You have no business taking it away from yourself, because this is not something that you have created. See, the problem in the modern human rights movement is that the thing has become humanistic. And of course, if it's humanistic, and if human beings have created the rights themselves, then none of those rights is inalienable. If human beings have created them, for heaven's sake, human beings can take them away. And they have no argument if they are taken away. That's why a solid theology is absolutely necessary in order to ground human rights, and particularly the right to life.
Dr. Montgomery, I'm thinking about a little-known writing of Luther on suicide, and I don't have it before me, but Luther likens the person who has committed suicide to a man who is overtaken in the woods by a robber, and that robber, in Luther's analogy, is the devil himself. He believed in many cases people were tormented by Satan to suicide. He sees it in very simple terms of good and evil, not only the good one, but also the evil one. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's quite correct. I mean, ultimately, if suicide is wrong, and if assisting suicide is wrong, then these are things that are demonic in character. They're things that the devil would want to have take place. They're not things that God would want to have take place. Now we have to be careful here, though. There are people who commit suicide as a result of essentially being out of their mind. They've gotten to the point where they're no longer rationally able to handle things, and this is very much like a madness. And where that sort of thing occurs, then we certainly shouldn't use the demonic category. This is an illness, a sickness, and this kind of thing happens. But there are also many instances where Luther's interpretation of this is exactly the correct one. If you don't mind a concrete example, I think that Hemingway's suicide is exactly that kind of thing. Hemingway was an atheist. He thought he had a right to do anything that with himself that he wanted to. When he discovered that he had cancer and that sort of thing, he decided that he would kill himself. Now, that whole scenario is utterly demonic. This is saying, I am my own God, and I can determine everything for myself. And that is exactly the nature of original sin. It's original sin, as C.S. Lewis points out in so many of his writings, it's exactly original sin that says, I am like the Most High. You know, this is Lucifer. I am like the Most High, and I can do anything I want with myself. That is utterly demonic.
You tell a story, you say true, but no less parabolic, about your, and very briefly as we conclude our conversation, tell us a story about when you served as the Director of Studies at the International Institute of Human Rights in Strasbourg. One of the guest lecturers, you say, came, a New York lawyer, and delivered a series of lectures on the right to die.
Well, yes, the lawyer thought that these avant-garde students at the International Institute of Human Rights would be really in favor of that sort of thing. Many of those students came from Africa and from countries, third world countries, and the students did not go along with this at all. And their position was that it's taken generations for their third world countries to get to the point of having a sense of human dignity, of recognizing the value of human life, and therefore they were the last ones who were going to go along with an easy euthanasia or right to die approach, which I thought was very interesting. You know, many of the politically correct human rights people in the West have no conception of what's going on in the rest of the world. any more, for example, than Anglican and Episcopal liberals have any idea what's going on among Episcopalians in Africa and South America. I mean, the really powerful Christianity is coming from those areas, not from the West. And it may well be that in the future we will find that that a solid theology is maintained much more by converts in the third world than our allegedly Christian civilization in the West.
With only about 30 seconds here, Dr. Montgomery, please let us know what's in store for us next time when we talk about the law and human cloning.
That's a very exciting subject because in England very recently, therapeutic cloning has been passed, allowed, by Parliament, whereas the United States, President Bush has refused to allow federal funding for it. So this will be a very exciting program. We'll raise the question as to whether Europe is now gone much more scientific than the United States, whether Bush is an old fundamentalist reactionary, or whether this really is a vital moral issue.
Folks, if you'd like a free information brochure on Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, it's held each summer in Strasbourg, France, or if you'd like to help us defend life from beginning to end by joining our Issues Etc. Reformation Club, it's our monthly donor program, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Dr. Montgomery, thank you again for being our guest. Look forward to next conversation.
Grand. We'll see you next week.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, a distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, joined us from Paris for this conversation. He's author and editor of more than 50 books, including Christ Our Advocate. We cannot take from ourselves what we did not give ourselves. God is the one who gave us life. If that and that alone were true, it would make suicide an effrontery to God. It would make it something that God has never authorized us, his creatures, to do. Now, if you can make the case that you gave yourself life, if you can make that case, then you might be able to make a case for suicide. But as far as I know of no human being living, no human being, whether they are healthy or ill or terminal or depressed or whatever they may be, who can make the case that they gave themselves life. And as long as they didn't give themselves life, they can't take it away. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.